Chapter 9, Self-Defense by Carol Anderson. One night in February 2014, Jesse Murray Jr. was with his wife at a bar on Old Dixie Highway in Jonesboro, Georgia, just 12 miles from downtown Atlanta. It may have been the 21st century, but it felt more like good old Dixie to Murray, who is African American and was being harassed by a group of 4 or 5 drunken white men. They were loud, obnoxious, and rude, and didn't seem to like it that Murray's wife, Tracy, was white. They bumped into the couple, interrupting their conversation. One of the men, Nathan Adams, allegedly told Jesse not to get near him again. Finally, Murray left Tracy at the bar and went to get his gun. He knew he needed to get her out of there, and he figured he might need protection to do so. Returning from his car, he was approaching the door of the bar when suddenly the white men surrounded him and fist after fist after fist pounded his face. It's not entirely clear what happened next, but when the unforgettable sound of gunfire shattered the air, the fighting stopped. Adams, who turned out to be a former police officer, was dead. Murray, with blood streaming down his black skin, knew that he had responded in self-defense. And he knew that as an American, he had a right to do so. Like a lot of states, Georgia had adopted a Stand Your Ground law, crafted by the National Rifle Association during the 2000s. The law gave a person the right, when faced with a perceived threat, to be justified in using force which is intended or likely to cause death or great bodily harm, only if he or she reasonably believes that such force is necessary to prevent death or great bodily injury to himself or herself or a third person, or to prevent the commission of a forcible felony. It also eliminated the previous requirement to retreat from danger if threatened, which was supposed to make lethal violence the last resort, not the first. Stand Your Ground laws, however, were designed to keep gun owners who shot someone from having to face criminal charges and to ensure that their actions were presumed legally justifiable as the starting point for any investigation. The laws were buttressed in 2008 and 2010 when the U.S. Supreme Court struck down strict gun control laws in Washington, D.C. and Chicago, on the grounds that a central component of the Second Amendment was the inherent right of self-defense. The court could have gone back even further than that. The United States has long embraced a legal tradition rooted in 17th century English common law, which established the Castle Doctrine. If one's home was invaded, the owner had the right to ward off the intruder. The Enlightenment philosopher John Locke laid out what the legal scholar David B. Koppel describes as the natural right of self-defense, the natural right to control and protect one's body and property. But as Jesse Murray would soon find out, this natural right is not universal and has never been. In the colonial era, black people, whether enslaved or free, were explicitly prevented from carrying weapons or defending themselves against white violence. The Second Amendment of the Bill of Rights granted citizens of the new country the right to bear arms in order to provide for a well-regulated militia. But the enslaved were not considered citizens, and in most states, even free black people struggled to exercise their citizenship rights. The citizenship of free black people was so contested that a series of laws, judicial decisions, and policies culminated in the 1857 Dred Scott U.S. Supreme Court decision, which asserted that black people had never been citizens of the United States. If they were, Chief Justice Roger Taney wrote, they would have the right to keep and carry arms wherever they went. Moreover, in the South, which had large enslaved populations, everyone understood that one of the purposes of the Second Amendment's well-regulated militia was to suppress uprisings of the enslaved. Though it did not explicitly say so, the Second Amendment was motivated in large part by a need for the new federal government to assure white people in the South that they would be able to defend themselves against black people. This was codified in a number of state laws in the antebellum period. These were supported by a series of court decisions, such as an 1843 case in Maryland that described free black people as a dangerous population that could not have access to guns even to defend their religious gatherings from attack. The 1846 Nunn decision by the Georgia Supreme Court ruled that a law curtailing open carrying of guns for white people violated the Second Amendment's natural right of self-defense, but kept in place an 1833 law banning free black people from carrying any type of gun whatsoever. In the modern era, gun violence most often occurs within racial groups, and state self-defense laws aren't explicitly racist in the ways those in the colonial and antebellum periods were. But when interracial violence does occur, these laws can end up protecting white people, but leaving black people vulnerable to white violence. You don't have to look any further than the infamous case of George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin. In 2012, in Sanford, Florida, Zimmerman, a 28-year-old white Hispanic man, called 911 as he stalked Martin, a black teenager, through a gated community. Zimmerman, who was carrying a loaded 9mm pistol, had previously made repeated calls to 911 about black men in the neighborhood. He ignored the instructions from the 911 operator not to follow the teen, claiming that Martin looked suspicious, that his type always get away. He ultimately put a bullet in Martin's chest. Although Zimmerman was the one with the gun and Martin was unarmed, the trial judge framed the jury's instructions around the tenets of stand your ground. Zimmerman could use deadly force if the disparities in the physical capabilities between him and Martin caused the gunman to fear for his life. The jury ruled that the killer had acted in self-defense. 2 years later, as Jesse Murray stood in a Jonesboro parking lot with a dead white man at the end of his gun, Georgia's stand your ground law was some comfort. But that evaporated as soon as the police arrested Murray and charged him with felony murder. At his trial, the very rock of his defense crumbled as the judge, Albert Collier, dismissed the stand your ground defense. He ruled that because the gun had gone off accidentally, it was impossible to claim that Murray had been standing his ground. In other words, one could not accidentally stand one's ground. Second, and equally important, Collier explained, Murray clearly couldn't have felt threatened by the white men who were beating on him. Those men were not doing anything to make Murray reasonably believe that deadly force was necessary to prevent death or great bodily injury to himself or a third party. Before the trial was over, Murray had pleaded guilty to a weapons charge and been sentenced to 5 years probation. The difference between the Zimmerman and Murray cases exposes the harsh reality that even in the modern era, the enforcement of self-defense laws varies widely according to race. Like many previous such laws, stand your ground depends on the perception of threat, and research shows that black people are often linked with danger in the minds of white people. In her 2019 book, Biased, the Stanford University psychology professor, Jennifer Eberhardt, shows that African Americans are consistently perceived as a threat. In one 2004 study, she and her colleagues cued subjects with pictures of African American faces, white faces, or no facial images at all, then progressively unblurred images of various objects, including weapons, and asked them to identify what they saw. The results found that subjects more quickly identified the weapons when cued with black faces than they did when prompted with white faces. Eberhardt summarizes the study, noting the stereotypic association between blacks and crime influences not only how we see black people, but how we see guns. Another set of studies, this one from Philip Atiba Goff, a psychologist now at Yale, documents how black boys are perceived as older and less innocent than white boys of the same age. Finally, The research of Anthony Greenwald, a University of Washington psychologist, reveals how in computer simulations, Black people are more likely to be shot than white people who dress and act similarly. This may be why, as shown in study after study, white people are decidedly more successful in invoking stand your ground as a defense than are African Americans. Stand your ground laws are only the latest form of self-defense legislation to be applied unequally. Since the nation's founding, our legal and political architecture has privileged the safety and self-defense of white people over that of Black people. As a consequence, the right to self-defense, so quintessential to American identity, has been experienced unequally by Black and white people. White people continue to use self-defense laws to protect themselves from perceived harm from African Americans. Black people often cannot use self-defense to protect themselves from actual harm by white people. The results have been devastating. The War of Independence against Britain revealed the colony's widespread fear of arming Black people and the differences between the North and the South in this regard. During the first few years of the war, the colonies banned Black people from joining the Continental Army. The pressure of a series of British victories and the ongoing and worsening reluctance of white men to enlist finally compelled a number of states in the North to offer freedom to their enslaved men in exchange for military service. But the Southern states, with vastly greater populations of enslaved people, were not so moved. Virginia agreed that free Black people could join the army, but the last thing they wanted was to give weapons to all those enslaved Black men they were holding against their will. Even when faced with overwhelming British force, the Southern states resisted arming enslaved people. After the British occupied Georgia and seized Savannah, they set their sights on South Carolina. In November 1779, the state had only 750 white men available to fend off the attack. George Washington sent an emissary to Charleston to ask the state to arm thousands of the enslaved people who lived there to fight off the British. This request would be one of many. South Carolina resisted. Washington's people kept pressing, exasperated by years of pressure from Washington's military commanders. In 1782, Edward Rutledge, the former governor's brother, reported, "We have had another hard battle on the subject of arming the blacks. I do assure you, I was very much alarmed." Despite the pleas, despite the British overrunning Charleston, the South Carolina government flat out refused to enlist the enslaved. The state's leaders said they would rather surrender to the British and take their chances with the king as traitors than to see those whom they held captive armed. The patriots prevailed, but that chasm between the protection of slavery at all costs and the creation of an independent nation predicated on the principle of equality would bedevil the founders. In 1787 in Philadelphia, at what would later be called the Constitutional Convention, James Madison and a group of 54 delegates came together to unite a federation of disparate states on the brink of collapse under one constitution and to create a much stronger central government. This would not be easy. Madison recognized that though all the delegates were determined to create a viable nation, there were two divergent agendas under the surface. The Deep South was intent on strengthening the slaveholders' power and protecting the institution of slavery. Meanwhile, the other delegates were motivated by a variety of moral, economic, and philosophical reasons. The asymmetry allowed the dream of the United States of America to be held hostage to the tyrannical aims of enslavers. When, for example, Governor Morris, who represented Pennsylvania, blasted the Atlantic slave trade as cruel and in defiance of the most sacred laws of humanity, John Rutledge of South Carolina issued an extortionist warning about any attempt to curtail it. If the convention thinks that North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia will ever agree to the plan for a constitution unless their right to import slaves from Africa be untouched, the expectation is vain. Unquote. Those threats worked to secure 20 additional years of the Atlantic slave trade, the Three-Fifths Clause, and the Fugitive Slave Clause, and they left a lasting impression on James Madison about how fragile the tendons were that bound the United States of America together. When it came time to debate federal control of state militias, the issue initially didn't draw much fire. The proposed constitutional language gave Congress the power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and deploying the various state militias in service to the United States to deal with invasions and insurrections. After the militia clauses made it into the draft, however, the trouble started with just a few days remaining in the Constitutional Convention. The strongest objection came from the Anti-Federalists in both the North and the South, who rejected the idea of a stronger central government. They argued against congressional control of the militia, believing that it was the pathway to a standing army, tyranny, and the destruction of democracy. Initially, the Federalists, like James Madison, prevailed. They had seen the ineffectiveness of the state militias during the War of Independence and believed that strong federal control was necessary. This was codified in Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 15 and 16, which gave Congress the power to summon for battle and organize the state militias. But as Pauline Mayer notes in Ratification, Madison also explained, as a sop to the South, that the militia clause in the Constitution gave the states a supplementary security by allowing Congress to enlist the help of other states in suppressing insurrections, including slave uprisings, or resisting invasions. But Madison's assurances did not mollify the Southern Anti-Federalists as they geared up for the state ratification conventions. For them, the state militias had a very specific purpose. They were key to crushing revolts by enslaved people and buttressing enforcement of the slave codes, laws that maintained the racial hierarchy by banning black people's access to firearms, literacy, and unfettered movement. Southern delegates worried that placing control of the militias in the hands of Congress was risky, because the federal government could decide not to fund or arm the state militias. In this situation, white people would be defenseless against those they enslaved, an unthinkable proposition. This anxiety was driven in part by arguments that had been made during the Constitutional Convention by delegates from the North, such as Governor Morris, who questioned the morality of forcing militias from the North, where numerous states had begun to legally end slavery, to travel south to crush enslaved people's freedom rebellions. The Southern Anti-Federalists' angst became more apparent as each state brought the document to its ratifying convention. In some, a dangerous movement of resistance to the Constitution began to emerge. By early 1788, the progress toward ratification was grinding to a halt. George Washington raised the alarm and insisted that Madison go to Richmond and use his persuasive powers to bring Virginia into the fold. In June, Madison and 169 others gathered at a convention in Virginia with ratification of the Constitution hanging in the balance. Madison quickly discovered that the hero of the American Revolution, Patrick Henry, and George Mason, another prominent enslaver, stood in the way. They strenuously objected that Madison had put control and arming of the militia in the hands of a federal government dominated by northern states, such as Pennsylvania and Massachusetts, that had already begun to end slavery. Henry and Mason made clear that this equivocation on human bondage meant that the central government could not be trusted with authority over the militia. The question hanging in the air at Virginia's ratifying convention, as the historian David Waldstreicher notes in his book, Slavery's Constitution, was, What would keep a Congress dominated by Northerners from refusing to defend the state from a slave rebellion? Mason predicted that the enslavers would be left defenseless, according to the legal scholar Michael Waldman. "They'll take your niggas from you," Patrick Henry warned the members of the Virginia legislature. "Slavery is detested in the North," he fulminated. In the end, Virginia narrowly ratified the Constitution, but only with amendments, including the right to a well-regulated militia, based on the 1776 Virginia Declaration of Rights. Only a few days earlier, New Hampshire had ratified the Constitution, making it the nation's official charter. But 3 of the 13 colonies had yet to ratify, and even some of those that did, like Virginia, made clear that they were doing so with reservations. In fact, many were clamoring to rewrite the Constitution in a new national meeting. Henry and his allies were also calling for a Bill of Rights to rein in the power of the federal government and give more authority to the states. They specifically wanted the language about the militia to limit how long state forces would be under national control and to place strict rules on how Congress would use the state militia. In other words, they did not want to be left defenseless. The intense anger that erupted in Richmond during the ratifying convention would push Madison to take a different tack in future negotiations. Over the next few months, as he ran for Congress, Madison decided that he needed to quell the discontent by crafting a Bill of Rights that would mollify the anti-federalists and enslavers, yet still leave the national government's power in place. After his electoral victory, Madison set out during the first Congress to craft a Bill of Rights. With everything at stake, he was like a man possessed. Congressman Theodore Sedgwick of Massachusetts thought Madison was so fixated on a Bill of Rights because he was, quote, constantly haunted by the ghost of Patrick Henry, who had made it so clear at Virginia's ratifying convention that he could not abide the idea that the federal government would control the militia. Pennsylvania Senator Robert Morris was also convinced that whatever had happened at the convention had made Madison, quote, so cursedly frightened that he dreamed of amendments ever since. The Bill of Rights, which focused on the limits of federal power, shut down the phalanx of opposition to the Constitution. The Second Amendment in particular, which declared a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, short-circuited Mason's, Henry's, and other Southerners' worries that the federal government would, in one way or another, render the militia impotent as a slave control device. The scholar Carl T. Bogus writes in a Law Review article, The Hidden History of the Second Amendment, as a Virginian, Madison knew that the militia's prime function in his state and throughout the South was slave control. His use of the word security in the Second Amendment is consistent with his writing the amendment for the specific purpose of assuring the Southern states, and particularly his constituents in Virginia, that the federal government would not undermine their security against slave insurrection by disarming the militia. The Second Amendment, ratified in 1791, codified for white citizens the right to bear arms and to protect themselves. If there were any doubts about who these rights pertained to, they were put to rest in 1800. When Virginia Governor James Monroe called out several regiments of the state's militia to thwart, before it could begin, a widespread revolt planned by an enslaved man named Gabriel, and then to hunt him and the other participants down. As the historian Herbert Aptaker wrote in American Negro Slave Revolts, as word of Gabriel's revolt spread, the nation from Massachusetts to Mississippi was terror-stricken. The response was to double down and make more explicit through legislation the prohibitions on black people owning guns. One Virginian wrote in the local newspaper that, "We must reenact all those rigorous laws which experience has proved necessary to keep slavery within bounds. In a word, if we will keep a ferocious monster in our country, we must keep him in chains. A little more than a decade before the Constitution was written, John Adams had worried that the colonies were so different, especially the ones with agriculturally based economies dependent on enslaved labor, that it would be a miracle if such heterogeneous ingredients did not at first produce violent fermentations. The uneasy union he had anticipated between the North and the South started to crack not long after it was forged. The slaveholding states demanded greater Northern complicity in maintaining human bondage, threatening secession unless Congress passed laws that made it the responsibility of others to return those who fled enslavement. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, in particular, meant that even black people who were born free or had managed to buy their freedom or escape slavery had no legal right to that freedom and limited legal means to defend themselves. But many in the North hated these laws and often refused to comply. It was this tension that led to an unusual situation in the small town of Christiana, Pennsylvania, where, for a rare moment, black people were allowed to defend themselves. Pennsylvania had begun a gradual process of abolition in 1780. Christiana was in Lancaster County, which bordered Maryland, a state that allowed slavery. A small community of Quakers and free black people, some of whom were fugitives, lived in Christiana. Black people had come together to create a self-defense community to fight off anyone trying to bring them back to bondage. In September 1851, an enslaver from across the state line in Maryland, Edward Gorsuch, went up to Christiana to retrieve his human property, four men who had fled north. He brought along his son, his nephew, and a U.S. Marshal, all of whom found themselves in a pitched battle with residents armed with pistols and farm equipment. Surrounded by approximately 80 black people wielding whatever kinds of weapons they could find, Gorsuch was killed and his son and his nephew wounded. The marshal fled the scene, looking for safety. After the killing, although some of the black residents of Christiana escaped to Canada, authorities rounded up a group of others, including a white man, Castner Hanway, and charged them with treason. In the eyes of the state, violating the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 was the equivalent of waging war against the United States. In his opening statement, the prosecutor did admit that the law was obnoxious, but he patiently laid out how the group at Christiana, overwhelmingly black with a smattering of white people, had knowledge of the statute and had refused to aid the U.S. Marshal in capturing Gorsuch's runaways. The judge's instructions to the jury, however, emphasize that those in what would be called the Battle of Christiana were just trying to protect one another from what they termed kidnappers. Slave catchers, the judge told the jury, had invaded homes and snatched people away, and it didn't matter if they were a free man or a slave. This odious business, spurred by the greed of rewards, had driven black people to resist aggressions. This wasn't about treason. This was about self-defense compelled by an unjust law. In fact, after that clear repudiation of the Fugitive Slave Act, no one was ever convicted for Edward Gorsuch's death or the wounding of his son and his nephew. The Republican and Daily Argus of Baltimore railed that Gorsuch's murder remains unatoned for and unavenged. Shortly after the verdict, a slave catcher, Thomas McCreary from Elkton, Maryland, came across state lines into Chester County near Christiana and snatched a 10-year-old free black girl named Elizabeth Parker. He gagged her and sold her to a slave broker in Baltimore who shipped her to New Orleans to be enslaved in the Deep South. McCreary then came back and grabbed her sister Rachel, who worked for a white farmer named Joseph Miller. Miller witnessed the kidnapping from afar and took off in hot pursuit. He and a group of his neighbors followed McCreary into Maryland to rescue Rachel. Instead, Miller was taken, tortured, poisoned with arsenic, and hanged. His body was found days later, strung up in a tree. Frederick Douglass's paper stated that the kidnapping scheme was a plot by bloodthirsty Marylanders to lure Pennsylvania abolitionists across the state line, where they could wreak their vengeance upon them without mercy and without justice. A judge dismissed the kidnapping charge against McCreary, and Miller's killers were never arrested. The judicial proceeding echoed like a tit-for-tat retaliation. Miller for Gorsuch, freedom for slavery. In the 1860s, the violent fermentations that John Adams had predicted erupted into the Civil War, leading to emancipation and the resulting amendments that ended slavery and codified citizenship for African Americans. This was not freedom given, this was freedom earned. Some 179,000 black men, 10% of the Union Army, fought in the war. An additional 19,000 served in the Navy. Black women participated too, most notably one well-armed conductor on the Underground Railroad, Harriet Tubman. A Union spy, she led as many as 300 black soldiers in destroying a Confederate supply depot on the Combahee River on June 2, 1863. The legal status African Americans had fought hard for should have provided the standing to protect one's body and property that had not been available to black people before. But this is not what happened. Shortly after the war, President Andrew Johnson granted amnesty to many in the Confederate leadership. Free from the threat of the gallows for committing treason, these white men, such as General Benjamin Humphreys, who had fought against the Union at the Battle of Gettysburg and then became governor of Mississippi, assumed positions in the newly formed state governments and passed legislation known as the Black Codes. These laws were designed to reinstall something close to slavery. They required African Americans to sign a yearly labor contract to work for a white employer, blocked their ability to testify in court against a white person, and banned freed people's access to and ownership of guns under the threat of a public whipping of 39 lashes. African Americans pushed back. Many had held on to their wartime firearms and resisted the neo-Confederate government's demand to disarm. They fought back as white state militias and paramilitary organizations worked closely with local governments to seize their weapons. Black people asserted in publications such as the Christian Recorder of the African Methodist Episcopal Church and the Loyal Georgian that they had Second Amendment rights and that stripping them of their guns was denying them the right to self-defense. The Loyal Georgian quoted a report by an officer of the Freedmen's Bureau saying that disarming black people would be placing them at the mercy of others. As black people defied disarmament, they scored some victories, but far too often they were outgunned, and they suffered brutal repercussions as they ran up against the unwillingness of federal officials and local Republican governments to enforce black citizenship. The slaughter was facilitated by President Johnson's removal from the South of black troops, which had been a significant part of the occupying army and the line of defense between the freed people and white violence. In late 1865 to mid-1866, all the black troops were removed from the South's interior and sent to coastal fortifications. And by January 1867, they had been expelled altogether. The result was catastrophic. After the war, President Andrew Johnson had sent a former general, Carl Schurz, to tour the South and report back on conditions there. Schurz unveiled a travelogue of death. He documented hunting parties where black men were chased down and shot, with dogs left to devour their faces. Near Montgomery, Alabama, he wrote, Negroes leaving the plantations and found on the roads were exposed to the savagest treatment. At Selma, he relayed the report from Major J.P. Houston, that 12 Negroes were killed by whites. In Choctaw County, Alabama, on separate occasions, black men were roasted alive. One of them was chained to a pine tree and burned to death. Then there were the gallant young men who make a practice of robbing black people. If any resistance is made, death is pretty sure to be the result. Between 1865 and 1868, white people murdered more than 1,000 African Americans in one area of Texas. In Pine Bluff, Arkansas, white people set fire to a black settlement and rounded up the inhabitants. A man who visited the scene the following morning found a sight that appalled him. 24 Negro men, women, and children were hanging to trees all around the cabins. As black people tried to defend themselves, white people massacred African Americans in Memphis, New Orleans, Colfax, Louisiana, and Hamburg, South Carolina. The historian, Annette Gordon Reed, called the carnage a slow-motion genocide. It was clear that any time a black person tried to fulfill their right to leave an employer or reunite with their family or demand payment for their labor, they could be violently attacked. The rise of the Ku Klux Klan and similar domestic terrorist organizations like the Knights of the White Camellia and the Red Shirts meant that the precarity of black life was the defining condition in post-Civil War America. Despite the subsequent repeal of the Black Codes, the rise of radical Reconstruction, helmed by the U.S. Congress, the advent of the right to vote for African American men in 1867, the ratification of the 14th and 15th Amendments, and the passage of the Third Enforcement Act, a law that criminalized white domestic terrorism, the Klan and other vigilante groups were undeterred. The bloodshed was so intense and the lack of justice so evident, despite the fact that black people were now voting and holding office, that in the mid-1870s, President Ulysses S. Grant painfully acknowledged that the slew of murders meant that white people clearly had the right to kill Negroes without fear of punishment and without loss of caste or reputation. Things were no different in the 20th century. In Atlanta in 1906, white men went on a killing spree against black people in the city. On trolleys, in barbershops, in hotel lobbies, on street corners, African Americans were hunted down and slaughtered. State militia members, in their own way, were part of the mob. They rampaged through Atlanta chanting, "We are rough, we are tough, we kill niggers and never get enough." In the face of this terror, black people had no stable right of self-defense. In Brownsville, a black neighborhood, residents took up their guns and prepared to defend themselves from the onslaught. As policemen approached the neighborhood, African-American sentries fired, thinking it was the mob attacking. Instead, one police officer died and four others were wounded. The state militia descended upon Brownsville and ransacked homes, terrorized the inhabitants, and confiscated every gun it could find. White brutality remained a steady fact of life for black people during this era. But some moments were set apart, such as the orgy of violence known as the Red Summer, which began ramping up as World War I was winding down. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People and others identified at least 25 major riots and mob actions, and at least 52 black people lynched. Many victims were burned to death between April and November 1919. In Arkansas that year, African-American sharecroppers in the town of Elaine placed armed sentries outside a church to guard their union organizing meeting. They knew, as one of the black men declared, that if their effort to join a labor union was discovered, the whites are going to kill us. Despite the sharecropper's stealth, as feared, The wealthy landowners had caught wind of the mobilization and sent a local deputy, a detective for the railroad, and a black prison trustee, Kid Collins, as one participant in the meeting said, to break up the meeting or to shoot it up. The sentry spotted them. The ensuing gun battle left one white man dead, the other wounded, and Kid Collins running back to town to alert the authorities. The political leaders defined the Black Sharecroppers Act of Self-Defense as the onset of a plot to kill all the white people in the county and perhaps the state. The governor called in the U.S. Army, which machine-gunned and shot hundreds of black residents. That same year, in Knoxville, Tennessee, a white mob gathered in a black neighborhood to kill as many African Americans as possible after a local sheriff thwarted the lynch mob's plan to hang a black man arrested for murdering a white woman. In order to hold off the aggressors from laying waste to their neighborhood, black residents overturned a gravel truck, created makeshift barricades, shot out the streetlights, and fired their rifles and pistols as the white mob attacked. Enraged that black people had the audacity to defend themselves, white officials called in the 4th Tennessee Infantry Regiment, which then leveled one machine gun blast after the next into black homes and businesses. The next year, another incident demonstrated the cost to black people of exercising their rights to participate in the political process and to protect themselves. When black residents in Ocoee, Florida, attempted to vote in the 1920 presidential election, white residents there tried to stop them. Poll workers challenged black voters' registration and payment of the poll tax, and required that they get their voting status certified by the town's notary, whom white leaders had deliberately sent out of town on a fishing trip. When one black man nevertheless tried to cast a ballot and was twice turned away, he began to document the disenfranchisement of African American voters, which enraged a white mob that had been hanging around the polling station intimidating black voters. The mob threatened to kill him. He fled for refuge to the home of one of the most prominent African Americans in Ocoee, July Perry. The armed mob followed. Perry was warned that they were coming. The men and women in Perry's household had guns, so they set themselves up to defend their home and their lives. But they couldn't repel the onslaught that came their way. A mob of around 100 white men broke down the door of Perry's home. The residents inside leveled their guns and fired. At least one white man went down. The battle had just begun as white reinforcements poured in from the surrounding counties. Perry's act of self-defense was met with more violence. A white mob lynched him that night. And over the next several days, white people murdered or ran out of town some 500 black residents. Ocoee remained an all-white town for 5 decades. Nearly a generation later, during the height of the Second World War, Lena Baker, an African-American woman in Cuthbert, Georgia, would also experience the lethal consequences of having no right to self-defense. Baker, a 44-year-old mother of 3 children, had been hired to care for a white man, Ernest Knight, who was 23 years older than her and had broken his leg. As Lila Bond Phillips writes in The Lena Baker Story, Knight would keep the woman captive in his mill house for days and repeatedly rape her. His son was scandalized and almost beat her half to death to compel that bitch to stay away from his father. But it was Knight, as a white man in rural Jim Crow, Georgia, who had the power. Late on the night of April 29, 1944, while her children were already in bed asleep, he went to Lena Baker's house, demanding that she come with him to his grist mill. She didn't want to go, but he took her anyway. The inevitable sexual violence was delayed, however, because he had promised one of his sons that he would go to church with him, so he locked her inside. When he came back a few hours later, on April 30th, he insisted on getting what he wanted. What she wanted, however, was to leave. She went for the door, and Knight pulled out a gun. They struggled over it. It went off, and a single bullet struck Knight in the head. After the shooting, Baker claimed self-defense. The prosecutor charged her with murder. The trial didn't even take a full day. The jury deliberated for less than half an hour and delivered a guilty verdict. The judge sentenced Lena Baker to death, the first and only woman to die in Old Sparky, Georgia's electric chair. Lena Baker's last words were, "What I done, I did in self-defense, or I would have been killed myself." Systemic violence against Black people was not just a Southern phenomenon. In California in the 1950s and 60s, the Oakland police force was notorious for brutally beating and killing unarmed African Americans. In one series of episodes, officers harassed and humiliated a young Black married woman by subjecting her to 3 days of venereal disease tests, beat an African-American man severely after they learned his wife was white, killed a Black man they had arrested for loitering, and claimed justifiable homicide for gunning down a man who they insisted had been burglarizing a building that showed no signs of forcible entry. This violence created a demand in the Black community that something be done. In 1966, Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale answered that call and formed the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, BPP. The BPP had a swagger and a militancy that resonated with a besieged community. Dressed in their uniforms of leather jackets and berets, the Panthers openly carried rifles and .45s while monitoring Oakland police officers making arrests. As an act of community self-defense, they policed the police. This was unsettling to many white people. A headline to a 1967 article in the San Francisco Examiner exclaimed, "Oakland's Black Panthers wear guns, talk revolution." Even more frightening, "It's all legal." The police invade upon conservative California Assemblyman David Donald Don Mulford to change the state's gun laws to make the open carry of firearms illegal and thus undermine the Panthers' community self-defense strategy. Mulford readily agreed. He was bolstered in his efforts by the National Rifle Association, the guardians of the Second Amendment. An NRA representative, E.F. Todd Sloan, helped draft new gun control legislation, California Assembly Bill 1591. Mulford adamantly denied that the bill was aimed at African Americans and offered assurances that there are no racial overtones to this measure. He publicly asserted that AB 1591 was designed to cover the Klan and the Minutemen, covert right-wing groups that, while well-armed, did not openly carry weapons in the state. Willie Brown, a Black assemblyman from San Francisco, saw through the subterfuge, noting that Mulford had opposed similar legislation until Negro showed up in Oakland, his district, with arms. And Mulford's private correspondence demonstrated that the Black Panthers were the target of his bill. He explained to Governor Ronald Reagan that the Black Panther movement is creating a serious problem and that AB 1591 had therefore been introduced at the request of the Oakland Police Department. For his part, Reagan, through his legislative secretary, informed Mulford that a prominent district attorney emphasizes the danger of the carrying of firearms by groups such as the Black Panthers and the need for control in this area. Many white people in America, in fact, saw the Panthers and the uprisings in Watts, Detroit, and Newark not as protests against police violence, but as indications of dangerous black pathology. A white woman in Joliet, Illinois, remarked, "When I see on TV these demonstrations, it makes me think of them as savages." Indeed, 57% of white people who lived in large urban areas said that the riots made them feel unsafe. A woman in New Jersey explained, "People have become afraid of Negroes. When you see them in groups, you think they're going to start a riot." Reagan and other officials quickly realized there was a political gold mine in white fear. Identifying African Americans as criminals, thugs, and mad dogs, and as an imminent threat to white communities, white lives, and white prosperity, allowed the racialized public safety policies of Jim Crow to survive in the post-civil rights era. It drove election campaigns steeped in the rhetoric of law and order, and successfully fueled soft-on-crime charges leveled against opponents. In this political environment, where black people were the threat, the violence that rained down on them seemed justified. Self-defense was not. A machine operator in California actually remarked, "I think there should be more police brutality, more martial law. Then they would have more respect for the law. Martial law is shoot now and ask questions later." As the scholar Susan D. Greenbaum noted in Blaming the Poor, the subtext of news reports and policy studies was that African Americans were dangerous, that poverty combined with inept upbringing and untamed rage were all coming to the surface in the successes of the civil rights movement. As the perceived threat grew, the focus of self-defense law was to protect white Americans. Black people were left exposed and vulnerable to white violence. In December 1984, on a subway car in New York City, a 37-year-old white man, Bernard Goetz, said he feared that he was going to be mugged by four young African Americans who had asked him for a cigarette and tried to bum $5. He pulled out his unlicensed gun and fired 5 bullets, hitting all his targets, leaving one teen paralyzed and with brain damage, and then left the train. When Goetz turned himself in to the police 9 days later and the prosecutor charged him with attempted murder, he became a hero to many, the subway vigilante. He represented the besieged white American who felt threatened by black people. Indeed, Goetz said he feared for his life, although there was virtually no hard evidence that the teens had tried to attack him before he pulled his gun and fired. Nonetheless, he claimed self-defense. The jury agreed. Behind the cases of Bernard Goetz, George Zimmerman, and Jesse Murray Jr. is a legacy of laws originally created to make it easier for white people to defend themselves against the black people they enslaved, who were defined as dangerous because they wanted desperately to be free. But when they won their freedom, black people did not also win the right to defend themselves. That has remained elusive to this day. In 2020, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights reported on the racial implications of stand your ground laws. The criminal justice system is 10 times more likely to rule a homicide justifiable if the shooter is white and victim is black than the other way around. In fact, the report notes that when a white person kills an African American, it is 281% more likely to be ruled a justifiable homicide than a white-on-white killing. A joint analysis by the Giffords Law Center and the Southern Poverty Law Center, citing the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights report, summed up the results. The consequences are predictably deadly and unequal.